Hi everyone, this is Chris DC, and what a pleasure this week to catch up with Alison Robertson for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Alison's research is in the area of subcultures, specifically BDSM and kink as religious practice. And Alison refers to how this is a notoriously sensitive area. Alison discusses the insider versus outsider question, and we learn that she is fascinated by areas where boundaries blur. Her participants might reject the label religion, but not the things that Alison believes make it a religion. Some people, as we discuss, have a very fixed understanding of what religion is. Alison talks about the therapeutic or confessional benefit for her participants when they talk about BDSM, and how some of them both wanted to be identified and didn't want to be identified at the same time. We discuss stereotypes and the judgments that people think may be attached to what they do, and we look at this in the context of nostalgia and the past. Now, Alison's first degree was in law, and she is still in touch with a friend from play school. In her experience as a PhD candidate, she found that the edgier you are, the better. But in an employment sense, people tend to be more wary. And Alison recounts the experience from when a referee once refused to write a reference for her because they didn't want to be associated with kink. We talk about assumed binaries and how it applies to pleasure versus pain. Alison tells me why she has a problem with the category of non-religion and about the different uses we give to the same word. Alison reflects on how at school religion was put in a container and cut off from everything else, and that this does religious studies a disservice. She did a PGCE in religious education, and we learn how she became interested in studying kink and why she would like it if more people studied it. Then towards the end of the interview, Alison discusses positive memories and the definition of nostalgia and the way kink can be a way of reshaping trauma. And then we end the interview by talking about the way Bat Out of Hell has helped her understand fandom and how there is nothing random about fandom. So thank you to Alison Robertson. It was wonderful to catch up with Alison for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is a great pleasure this week to have Alison Robertson as my latest nostalgia interview guest. And Alison, we were saying that we've met a couple of times at conferences, and you've had some amazing successes lately with your publications. And I think, am I right in thinking that literally yesterday you had a new book out?
A new chapter in a book, yeah. So it's a series on religion and the senses that's in progress. And I've got a chapter in the one on religion and touch. My author copy arrived yesterday. I think it came out a week or so ago. Yeah. But you know, they don't tell you till your copy turns up in the post.
No, I think you're right. And also, when books sometimes come out, you know, you may have already started on another project, and often it's not the idea. There's not like I always get, you know, I'm very impressed by how journalists manage to write a very detailed story, like on the day it happens, and it's in actually in physical copy form the next morning in the post. And you're thinking, how do they do that when you're writing an academic book and it takes like 5 years?
It's a totally different world, isn't it? Academic publishing is a different time scale to anything else I've ever come across, to be honest.
Actually, that happened. I remember what I was doing a book on religion and film once, and it was when The Passion of the Christ came out, and they said, oh, as the film's coming out on Friday, can you just write 10,000 words? And I did, and I thought, this is the most topical chapter I could have written. And then when the book came out like 2 years later, it was like, oh, yeah, but everyone else has written on The Passion of the Christ, so what makes your chapter distinctive? And you're like, yeah, but I wrote it before the film even came out. I'd love to hear, Alison, about your own research area.
So my main interest is subcultures, if I had to put it into a sort of broad category. But my doctoral research, and an area that I'm still really interested in and still doing a lot of thinking about, is on BDSM or kink. So that's bondage, domination, submission and masochism, for anyone listening who's not familiar with that acronym. And in looking at that, so my doctorate and my book is on that as a religious practice, by which I don't define religion the way certainly most lay people I talk to, as in non-academics I talk to, understand religion. I usually have to follow that up with that. I don't mean what you think I mean.
And I think that's interesting, because I remember when I met you at conferences, and this is my utter ignorance, and, well, I've said it, I have to finish this sentence now. I was thinking, BDSM, I think I know what it means, but I need to check. And it's interesting because you were doing research in an area that obviously raises eyebrows, but it's also kind of the sort of territory that, like, I suppose, with my stuff on film 20, 30 years ago, you're like, but why aren't people writing about it in that sense? It's not like you're doing something that's completely peripheral or maybe sort of marginal in terms of what's respectable, what's mainstream. But actually, you know, you mentioned the word subculture. Well, subcultures often can be very, very big, and they can actually be, and we don't know how big subcultures are sometimes, because obviously sometimes people perhaps are not inclined to come and expose themselves.
The kink is such a huge thing and it's so complex, perhaps there ought to be a lot more research on it. But I think it's that reluctance to expose themselves maybe is one of the reasons. I mean, it's notorious as a sort of sensitive area, quite hard to get people to talk to you, or at least allegedly it's quite hard to get people to talk to you. It's the difference, it's where the insider outsider question becomes really pertinent, I think, because I spoke to several people who said they wouldn't have talked to me at all if I wasn't an insider. And I spoke to one person who, fascinatingly, she said she would have spoken to me, but she would have told me different stuff if I was an outsider. And I think that in itself, that is a really worth exploring. What are outsiders getting that is different? You know, even if they're speaking to the same people, what are they getting that's different? And also the nature of the experiences that you're talking about. And I think again, this is probably true across all subcultures, is you end up with a level of conversation that's taking place in a sort of inside a shorthand. You get, well, you know what I mean, it was like this, but it wasn't like that, because you know what I mean. And as a researcher, of course, your job is then to try and unpack that, say, well, I think I know what you mean, can we put it like this? And you sort of work through it to find a mutually agreed explanation, but you are relying on that, no, I do know what you mean, and yes, it is hard to put into words, but please can we try?
Yeah, and it's funny because I was just recording a lecture for the first years next week, and it was all sort of phenomenology and insider and outsider. And the idea that everyone, I mean, I suppose I was, you know, a few years ago thinking sometimes that you think, well, you know, when you're writing an essay as an undergraduate or even perhaps doing a PhD, sometimes you're sort of thinking, I want that sort of like definitive or that really good argument that people reading it will say, yes, you've nailed it. We can't argue with you because you're using the best scholarship. But then you realize everything is contextual, that you can't write in the abstract on war, for example, if there's as there was when I was working on a book with Gay Ortiz on with the Iraq war, and suddenly her chapter on war was largely about the war that, and I thought, oh, but in 10 years time people might be thinking, oh, this seems a bit passé. But it's like, yeah, but everyone is writing from their own experience. You can't pretend otherwise. You can't say, well, really, we're writing about something objective, or, you know, everyone is going to be coloured in so, or prejudiced in some way by something that is obviously very much about where they're coming from, the sources they use, the culture of the time. And you know, so you can't write I couldn't have written the same thing 30 years ago as I'd be writing now.
The biggest sort of personal shift for me, for my PhD actually, was coming to that realisation. And also realising that made me happy. I'm fascinated by those sort of fuzzy areas and the places where the boundaries blur. You know, the obvious, this goes in that category, that goes in that category, is far less interesting to me than the place where you go, well, I could put it here for these reasons, or I could put it here for these reasons. And one of the things that was really, that a lot of people seem to find interesting about my research, is that I'm working with a category that literally every single one of my research participants rejects. They reject the label religion, but what they don't reject is the things that I say make that a reasonable label. And I had this conversation with all of them. It was an important part of the interview, about what they think religion means, what it means to them. And then I would say to them afterwards, well, okay, this is what religion means to me, and I'm interested in this tranche of things, and I think you've talked about those things, so is it okay if I say, while accepting you don't call it religion, is it okay if I say that it is? And everyone said that it was, which in itself is another really interesting thing, because they all had the option to say, no, I absolutely don't want you to use that term in relation to me, I'm withdrawing my material from your research. Nobody did that, but I had really aggressive anti-religious reactions from some people, and one person makes me feel sick. The word itself makes me feel sick, but I don't want to talk about it. Really strong feelings. And yet she's talking about all sorts of things that come up in religion. She's talking about spiritual connection and transcendence and relationship in that sort of non-tangible way. That whole And it's not even a contradiction because it's so common, I don't think you can really call it a contradiction, but that sort of holding fast to the category on one hand and scrubbing the category out entirely with the other hand, it's fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is, because, and I found this in my own experience of, you know, and I've mentioned this in other interviews I've done before, that I can stand in front of my students for 3 hours on a Thursday afternoon and talk about the death of God, or what, you know, it's one of the modules I teach. And it's a very good, fluid, dialogical sort of conversation, and we're prepared to sort of see where what sort of boundaries there are, and you know, looking at what was okay in the 60s and what is not okay and what is okay now. And then you go to the supermarket, and then someone, and this happened to me 1 year, literally half an hour later, someone says, "Oh, so what do you teach?" And you say, "Oh, I do religious studies." And then you just know that the conversation that follows, you know, you're just thinking, "Oh, I wish I hadn't come to this checkout," because suddenly you realize that you no longer have that cloak, almost, that sort of, you know, when you know, there's the professional, I'm doing my job and I've got my notes and I know what I'm doing. And then there's the sort of, I'm at the mercy of somebody who's, you know, it's a different sort of power relationship. And I've actually found myself in McDonald's or at the supermarket talking about whether I believe in God and why I teach religious studies, but don't go to a church, a particular church. And I'm thinking, this is driving me insane.
I have had exactly that experience, and I suspect most of our colleagues have as well, because people have this really very definite idea of what religion is, and it must be the one that applies to you. Mm. And in fact, to the point that some people, actually both in sort of personal conversations and in my research interviews, they responded to the question, "What does the word mean?" with, "Well, I don't believe in God." Mm. So, well, that isn't what I asked you. It's not even close to what I asked you. But that connection is so... it's so established.
Yeah. And so with your participants, with the people that you're interviewing, how do you get around this? Because are you talking about, I mean, do they know that the word religion is perhaps something that you're not being prescriptive about, or you're not sort of saying, "Oh, I'm going to use the word religion and it has all these connotations, I wanted to talk about it"? Or are you trying to sort of, as you say, it's like the elephant in the room, you're using the very term that actually is a problem, but if you take the word away, everything else kind of fits exactly your criteria.
Most interestingly, very few people actually asked me anything about what academic discipline I was in when they agreed to do an interview. I was expecting everyone would ask that, and I had a number of strategies for trying to deal with it, and I didn't actually have to use any of them, because I don't know whether they think all universities have a kink research department or they assumed it was psychology, I don't know, but very few people asked. And I left it till the end of my interview. So they were very unstructured interviews. I had a sort of some themes that I wanted to deal with, and I had a couple of specific questions I asked everybody. But otherwise, they just sort of unfolded very conversationally. But among those specific questions was, what does religion mean to you? What does spirituality mean to you? Do you use either of them to describe yourself? And then I explained how I was using those terms, because I don't really think there's a difference between those terms fundamentally. I explained how I was using them, and I asked them if that was okay. So they certainly did by the end, but I didn't want to do it up front unless I absolutely had to, because I thought it would then sort of preload some of the things people were telling me. So I introduced it by saying I wanted to talk to them about their experiences and the values that they put on their practice. So the only criteria, I had two criteria for being a research participant, and only two, they were that you had to have tried it in real life, because while there is some fascinating stuff to be done on fantasy kink and kink online, it was real world experiences I was interested in talking about. So they had to have done it in real life, and they had to consider it as an important thing in their life or to themselves. And I unpacked what that, or I tried to unpack what that importance meant, because that was part of the issue for me. That's part of what makes it a subculture, is you incorporate it into your identity. And it's part of what makes religion an appropriate category for it, to my mind, is if you're using it to explore the meaning of life, to use a banal phrase, you're doing what religion does. And people are absolutely using it to explore the meaning of life.
Yeah, and I find that really fascinating, because in a way, it's my work is obviously in religion and film, but it's always interesting how you sort of feel that when people think, "Oh no, I'll go to the cinema to relax or to have a bit of fun," but actually the questions that are posed, and you see this in the conversations on social media and also the conversations people have outside the cinema or whatever, that they're engaging in theological questions, but that doesn't mean to say that they believe in God, but they deal with the same questions that I might be engaging with in an academic context. And that's why I find this really interesting. And I think that sometimes those boundaries don't work, but you must have learned so much yourself. I mean, this is the thing that I find really interesting, that you're doing this research in an area where people are obviously telling you some very personal sort of experiences, but there must be a sense in which through that you are finding perhaps, and I'm assuming that you must do, some very sort of unexpected sort of, and also, I mean, it sounds like a confessional. It sounds like in many ways people are talking about something, they trust you to talk about it, but that must have, you must come away from those sometimes thinking, wow, you know, this, you feel very honoured, privileged for people to share that with you. They may not share with their close family members.
Almost exactly that term. I had one person like, oh, I think there's definitely some therapeutic benefit to come out of this conversation. And yes, at least one person used the term confessional. And interestingly, a couple of other religious terms crept into some of the conversations that are talking about the sort of sacredness of the experience, because the experience itself is an honour in a similar sort of way if someone gives you that level of trust within the kink experience. So it's, I mean, that's a more visceral level of trust, but it's the same sort of idea. So people are telling me things that theoretically at least they could be criminally prosecuted for. Looking at the law in this country and the way it's practiced, there are people who've lost custody of their children because their kink interest has become public. So people are trusting me with something quite serious and profound, and I guess that's another reason why it's difficult culture to talk to, maybe. But I was talking to people outside this country as well, where the law is different and perhaps stricter, perhaps less stricter. And yes, it did. I felt like I got to know some of these people really, really well. I felt like I made a really intimate connection with some of these people. And a number of them asked me, you know, can we connect on FetLife, which is like the kink version of Facebook? Can we connect on FetLife? Can we be virtual friends after doing this, or is that something that wouldn't be appropriate for research? And I didn't feel it would be inappropriate for my research, since I included people who were already my friends in my research pool. So I did, I made some friends through it, because we were talking about stuff at a level that you can't necessarily talk to everyone about.
Yeah. And is anonymity an important part to people? Because I'll rephrase that question to show where I'm coming from, because I've had people interview me sometimes, and maybe that's why I wanted to do this whole nostalgia thing, because I thought I want to be the one to ask these questions. And somebody says, oh, don't worry. And people even say that to me now if they're interviewing me over something. They say, don't worry, it'll all be anonymous. And I'm thinking, actually, and also because I couldn't do like the nostalgia interviews anonymously, because if someone's talking about their own life experience and it's very specific to them, then it's hard to see how you can do that in an anonymous way, because the whole point is that it's somebody's real life.
There'd be identifiable stuff, right? I've read a lot about this before I actually did any of my real interviews. But something really interesting came out, or I think is really interesting, and it came up again while I was working on the book from my thesis, which also came out recently, while I was working on that with the proofreader, because he kept coming back to me with names, and he kept going, surely this name, this should have a capital letter. And I was saying, no, it shouldn't have a capital letter, because it's the play name, it's the scene name of this person, and they don't capitalize it, and that matters because it tells you something about them. A lot of subs, lifestyle submissives, don't capitalize their scene names. And then he would come back with another one going, so this is, you know, Master Bob, or whoever it would be, surely Master is the surname and we should just call him Bob. So no, his identity is Master Bob. That really matters. I don't care what the convention is. And they kept coming up with these. And I think it's tied to the same thing, because I didn't use people's real name. I did say to them they could specify what name I used if they wanted to. And those people who had seen names, almost without exception, wanted me to use those. So they did. They wanted to be identified within that scene, within that milieu. They must go, yeah, this is me. This is me. This is absolutely me. But outside of it, they didn't want to. And even the ones who said I could choose a name, at least two of them specified the capitalization point. So said, I don't mind what you call me, but if you're talking about me within a scene context, I need a lowercase. Again, it's one of those contradictory things. I want to be identified, I don't want to be identified at the same time.
Yeah, and there must be a really big level of trust, because in order for you to find the participants in the first place, it sounds like you knew some of them anyway, and I guess it's word of mouth, and I guess, but also it must be a fascinating thing to do, because you kind of know that there's experiences out there, but you also know that there are sensitivities. And I'm also guessing, although, and I'm obviously not asking you to divulge this, but I'm guessing there are people who may have, in terms of their jobs, in terms terms of their family circumstances, you just want to be cautious.
A kink researcher in the States says the kink scene that she researched in is full of tech people, you know, IT kind of people, disproportionately so. And I think that's interesting, and why that would be is interesting. I didn't ask those sorts of questions, so I can't say. I didn't ask them because I wanted to try and be able to get to this intimacy about the stuff they're actually doing. I didn't want to be talking about it in abstract, because I think it's very easy to talk about it in abstract. I could say to you now, oh yeah, it's an amazing flogging scene last night, Chris. And you know, I'd be going, yes, I know what flogging is. But unless you've done it, it doesn't actually tell you a great deal about what it is. It's an activity that I imagine you can picture, and that's probably as far as it goes if you don't have an experience to put on it. And I wanted to get deeper into that. I wanted to get into the things that go around that, because nobody just flogs someone else for an hour. That's not, and even if they did, there'd be all sorts of other things going on in here and between them. And what you call it is the thing that stuck out most to you at the time during the scene. It doesn't mean it's the only thing that you did. So I wanted to start getting into those more. And that meant I was going to be asking people to go into a level of detail that perhaps they would be less comfortable with doing if they thought that I knew more about them. So the people, as I snowballed, so I started with people that I knew and I snowballed out from there. So I did end up interviewing a fair number of people who I had never met before. And a fair percentage of those I could not now contact again, because one of the things that I promised them was that once my doctorate was finished, the contact details I had for them would be destroyed. And I did that. So I did. I mean, I don't even have real names for some of these people. That was part of the, that was part of the trust thing. And I took consent. And again, this took some working out, but I took consent to participate in the form of a verbal statement. So all of my interviews have this verbal statement recorded at the beginning that says, I understand what this is about and I'm consenting to my material being used, so that I didn't have to have any record. That people could then be worried about ending up in the wrong hands. And I think being upfront about that sort of sent an initial signal of being trustworthy, if you like. It was one of the first things I told people, is that I'm not going to hold any personal data on you. I'm not going to ask you about anything that would make you easily identifiable. And I think perhaps that led to a sort of, oh, okay then. And, you know, I gave people the choice of where we met for an interview, all sorts of little things like that. And in a lot of ways, it's very similar to hooking up with someone to play with them, actually, because, you know, a lot, if you're not lucky enough to be in a relationship with someone who shares your kink, a lot of people are hooking up with people online. And you have to do that same sort of dance. Can I trust this person? Can I trust this person to understand me? Can I put my safety in this person's hands? Do we have enough in common? What if they're out to blackmail me? You know, all those sorts of things. It's a similar kind of dance. So I wonder if maybe kinky people would make really good researchers in any sensitive area for that reason. I don't know.
Yeah, I was interested in what you said actually about people who work in the tech industry are like perhaps disproportionately going to be involved in kink, because this notion of counterpoint interests me. It's the idea that I'll give an example. I was talking to a friend who said that one of his own friends, I think they went to school together, has a very sort of very organized life and an organized job. I think he works in a car factory or something, but very, very organized. Everything is sort of just so. But his personal life is apparently completely out of control, and you're sort of thinking, so by day you're sitting in a nice neat office and you know your schedule is all very fixed, and then suddenly everything falls apart in your personal life, and I always find that really interesting, that it's almost as though you see people in certain contexts and in certain places. I mean, I have it sometimes, you know, when I go to the cinema they say, oh, you're our most regular customer, but I say, but they say that in the other cinema I go to as well, in coffee shops, oh, you're our most regular customer, but you also thinking, but how much do they know about me, you know, because they see me as the person who goes to the cinema all the time, but you know, there's 101 other things going on which some people are privy to. Lots of people are privy to lots of parts of my life, but I guess there aren't that many people who are privy to all of it. So we're all dealing with, you know, like I put stuff on Facebook, people might think, God, all he ever does is go to the cinema. Well, I wish, but I can see why it would look like that, because that's the stuff that I put out.
The idea of contrast is interesting, like having an ordered life on one hand and a chaotic life on the other. And it's the stereotype, certainly of submissive men, I think, is that they're all high-powered businessmen in real life and then they go and submit to someone. But stereotypes exist because quite often there's a truth behind them, don't they? And I think that contrast is certainly true for some people. I've certainly spoken quite recently to a couple of dominants who are saying, you know, this, doing this, is so far from how I live my life Male dominance in particular often like to tell you that they're a feminist and then, oh, I believe women are equal, I just happen to want to beat you right now, but I believe women are equal and I would never really hit somebody. And that sort of, it's not a justification, it's almost a confusion they have about themselves, in that this is how I see myself here, but then here I look like this. And I don't know how to put those two things together, but I know that they do go together.
Yeah, and I remember when Facebook was, well, it probably wasn't in its infancy, but I suppose I was a late arrival. So, but it was probably about, I don't know, eight, nine years ago when a colleague at work said, you know, well, you have to be, you know, down with the kids. you have to have a social media presence because the students are saying things about you, not necessarily you individually, but about the department, you know, on social media. So we need to know what's being said. So suddenly I was given access by one of our postgraduates, I think, to Facebook. And then suddenly I had access to all the students. And then I was thinking, though, that I don't think that the students know that I can see this, because I was seeing students who I was, you know, I'm used to seeing them in the classroom and they're all very, you know, respectable and doing their academic study and writing their essays and doing all the things that obviously in the context in which I know them is good. But what I was seeing on social media was all their sort of the other side of their life when they're down the student union of an evening. And in some cases, perhaps putting themselves in or showing themselves with people and doing things that perhaps if they knew their lecturer was watching that, they'd be embarrassed. I was embarrassed. And so I actually sort of, for years, I didn't use Facebook. And I just thought, actually, this really is crossing a line, because I'm not sure I should be seeing this. And if they knew I was seeing it, then it would be embarrassing. But also, it could affect the dynamics, which actually are, you know, I'm the lecturer, they're the student. And we it's not necessarily healthy for anyone to see what they're entitled to do of an evening. But there must be that element in terms of your own research.
Yeah, I think so. I do think so. In this sort of, it comes out, certainly in the conversations that I had, it comes out in hedging almost, and it happened a lot. So, and in a number of contexts. So the obvious one is sadism, because almost nobody wants to call themselves a sadist. And I find this really interesting. And I've had some personal conversations with people who are approaching me to see if I might want to play with them, who are telling me that I can't possibly be a masochist because there's no such thing. And what that actually translates to is, you can't be a masochist because if you're a masochist, I'm a sadist. And I really don't want to call myself a sadist because that would be wrong. And so they try to find other names for it, even though from an outside perspective, somebody watched what they're doing, that is, the sadism is the only label you have for it. So it comes out in that, but it also came out really interestingly. And again, it happened a fair few times. People started talking about transcendent experiences or experiences that blur reality in the sort of broad category of religious experience. So they lost track of time, or they lost sense of their body, or they lost awareness of the space. It's called spacing in the scene. It's quite a well-known thing in the kink scene. Subspace would be more commonly talked about than dom space, but dom space is a thing too. It's an altered perception, it's an altered consciousness. And people would start talking about that, or they'd start talking about the energy exchange between them and their partner, and then they would suddenly stop and they would say, but of course I'm a scientist and I realize this makes no sense. Or words to that effect. So, like, you know, someone was talking to me about energy exchange and they go, but I realized we weren't physically exchanging anything. Like, well, but you felt like you were, and that's what I'm interested in. But it's fascinating that they felt the need to hedge that. And it's one of those, what I want you to know about me, as opposed to what I fear I'm now telling you about me, the judgments that they thought I might attach to them using those words, and how that related to how they wanted me to see them. And I guess that's the same sort of thing you're talking about from your perspective, how you wanted to see your students as opposed to how they were presenting themselves on Facebook is not stuff that you wanted to know about them. So I think it works both ways around.
Yeah. And what was interesting is that some of the students who were like really worried about their degree and actually panicking and having to, you know, really, you know, the degree was all encompassing and they were worried about deadlines and they were emailing me in the middle of the night sometimes and panicking. And then you'd see a very, well, of course, pictures are deceptive, but sometimes you'd see them very relaxed, very comfortable, and actually sort of really enjoying themselves. And actually, that was good. But it was always like, that's not the side of you that I've ever seen. And also part of me then thought, actually, maybe something's wrong here, because it's, and that's the difference between the student-lecturer relationship and a relationship that sort of comes in many other parts of life where there's more of an equality, or you can divulge something, but you sort of, there's no It's peer to peer rather than, you know, having that, you know, teacher student dynamic. And I think that's interesting as well. And I've learned a lot in terms of, because obviously this is a nostalgia project, but to go back over the people I knew 20, 30 years ago and try and almost sort of like look back and think, okay, kind of things make a bit more sense when you look at it from the vantage point of now, because there were things that people, I mean, mental health is a good example. Mental health is obviously a very, very serious challenge. And we in universities are able to deal with that because we have resources in place. So if a student says that they have particular issues, it may be physical health, maybe mental health, you know, we are able to support them. It's not like, oh, we don't know the answer to that. We can, there's a go-to person and all sorts of strategies in place. But 30 years ago, there wasn't. So that doesn't mean to say that people didn't have mental health issues. It's the fact that they couldn't talk about them. So of course you're looking back and thinking, ah, so how did they cope and how did they manage? And how did they, in some cases, perhaps manage to maybe put up a pretense because they weren't able to, able, you know, they wanted to be seen to be managing and but there was no one to help them. So they just have to somehow make do. And what that must have done to them personally must have been exhausting and actually really, you know, from today's point of view, really unacceptable.
Yeah, it is. Like you say, the nostalgia of it. I was just thinking back to when I was an undergrad and thinking I'm really quite glad social media wasn't around when I was an undergrad. I think it would have felt like one more pressure to me. I probably still am socially awkward. So the whole sort of the standard student thing, and I don't drink either, so the standard student thing really didn't work for me. And I think social media would have been one more pressure on that, would have made it one more just one more damn thing to try and deal with, really. And I suspect it probably works that way for some people now, but it's also a letting off steam and, like you say, a means of you understanding the person you see in your lecture theatre isn't necessarily the whole person, and they're maybe not even necessarily showing you their best side or the side that you can most engage with. It's we get used to talking about things in absolutes, don't we? Our social media is so intrusive, there's so much pressure, there's so much. But it has the good side to it as well, or it wouldn't have taken off quite as well as it has.
Yeah, and also for a lot of people, it is a very sort of creative and liberating space. The issue, I suppose, is when, and I think this because I post a lot of stuff publicly, but I'm also, and there's nothing I would ever put out that I wouldn't be happy for people to see. But sometimes you just think, yeah, but you don't really know who's looking at this. And maybe, just maybe, in 5 or 10 years' time, you know, you might think, maybe on the evening that I posted that, you know, I couldn't have anticipated this. So, but then again, on that basis, you'd never do anything.
I think it's got to be a thing that we get better at as a society, is this exactly what you were just saying, is putting things in the context of 30 years ago. And I think this, you know, every so often these scandals appear of tweets somebody sent when they were 16 and now they're 25 and famous. That's being held against me, like, but they were 16. You know, some of the things that I said when I was 16, if they'd been recorded for perpetuity, you know, just think about that for a minute. And at the moment, we're really bad at doing that as a society. We're really bad at going, people change. Something you said then is not the same as something you might say now. We've got to find, if we're going to keep using social media as much as we do, we've got to find mechanisms to do that with, I think, socially, to understand context changes and times change and people change within them. And maybe nostalgia is a way to help do that. Because if you look back at where you were when you were an undergrad, it gives you that sort of insight in a different way, perhaps, to looking at it from a lecturer's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you find then that you, because you mentioned your first degree, could you have imagined doing the research then that you're doing now?
No, probably not. Although my first degree was in law, and it did lead me to the interest in religion that led me ultimately to my research. Mm. But if you'd said to me that I was going to be able to put kink together with religion back then, no, I would probably have laughed, as indeed many people have over the years when I've talked to them about it.
How do you find then, because I didn't realize that your first degree was law. Now, are you in touch with anybody from those days?
Not directly. I mean, I'm Facebook friends with a couple of people from those days, I suppose, but yeah, no one I talk to regularly. So I do have a couple of very good friends who I've known since way before that, who knew me all the way through that and still know me now. So my oldest friend I went to play school with, which I believe is quite unusual to still be really close to someone you went to play school with. So yeah, I have people who knew me, have known me all the way through that journey. But people who I only knew in that part of the journey, only a sort of peripheral contact with them, I guess.
Yeah, and in that sense, do you kind of feel that academia has moved on a lot to allow you? I mean, do you still feel that, you know, is there the opportunity for you to do this sort of research? Or do you feel that there's still lots of barriers that are being set up before you?
My experience is that there are barriers, but it depends where you mean by barriers. Mm. So I think, I mean, I think I got a certain distance because people were simply interested in how you go from law to religion, and that has been an interview question in job interviews more times than I can remember. It was a question in my interview from my PhD as well. How do you go from here to here? And they could see the qualifications I'd gone through to get from here to here, but they still wanted to hear me talk about it because it seemed like a very different thing to most people. So you get a certain step on that sort of, I don't understand how these things go together, but clearly you do. Let's talk about that. I think when you're researching something that seems counterintuitive to most people, and I'm thinking about all the people I know who did PhDs at more or less the same time I did and the various places that they are now, I think as a PhD candidate, the sort of the more weird and more edgy you are, the better. That's what universities want. That's what conferences want people to talk about. It's fascinating stuff. Everyone's interested in it. I think once you start looking for people to pay you in an employment sense to do research, I think they get a lot more wary about it. That is my experience. So I think it was an advantage when I was a PhD candidate. I think people are still fascinated by it now, but they don't want to pin themselves down to employing somebody who's got that research interest because that would look wrong, perhaps freaky. One of the things when I was applying to do my PhD, and with hindsight, I should perhaps have given this more weight than I'd went out. I would always have researched this. I don't think you can do a PhD on something that you're interested in. But with hindsight, it was perhaps a flag that I wasn't going to be able to walk straight into a research job afterwards. So I did my master's at Heathrop College, University of London, on the psychology of religion. And I wrote my dissertation for that on mental health and religion. So I looked at the difference between choosing pain in what would be broadly considered a pathological context, so self-injury, and extremes of religious asceticism, where the difference was, where that difference got drawn. I really enjoyed writing the essay, and it led on to my PhD in both obvious and less obvious ways, I suppose. But my supervisor for that dissertation had agreed to be my reference for doing PhD. And I believe I had told her what I wanted to do it on. But ultimately, when they asked her for the reference, she refused to provide it because she didn't want to be associated with research into kink.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that really extraordinary because the whole point of education in that sense is that you're prepared to ask. I mean, as long as you're doing it methodologically in a rich way and that you do so using correct sources, and by correct sources, I mean, use correct referencing systems, and you do it in an, you know, it's a game that you're playing. It's, you know, academia is a game of sorts, and you know how to follow the rules. You can't say, oh, you're not allowed to research that. But it's like, well, you make the case for if it's PhD standard, well, you know.
That there was a university prepared to offer me the opportunity to do a PhD, that would have been proof in itself. And also, again, what I find striking is she would have been perfectly prepared to write me a glowing reference for research into anorexia, into pathological self-harm. Mm-hmm. The idea that people might enjoy pain on some level or submission on some level, that was a step beyond the pale. That was a step too far. And I think that's interesting. But I also think that's far more, I don't want to say common exactly. I think your average person in the street, whatever their background academically or their job, is fascinated by it and eager to talk about it. I think it's when you start to attach it to things that perhaps have cultural capital attached to them, like being a professor within a university or having status of a particular kind, and then things become uncomfortable. So I encountered a similar thing with regard to self-harm when I was doing my teacher training. And I have a vivid memory of in my first practice school, we were being given some guidance on child abuse and reporting. And our professional tutor, she had this diagram and it had marks, parts of the body where signs of abuse are most likely and they're parts that are hard to damage by accident. And I said to her, I said, this is really interesting because those are also the most common places for self-injury. What's the procedure for that if you see that? And she said, exact words, she said, "I don't want to talk about that. It's not nice."
Yeah.
Exact words.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how sometimes you have supervisors. I mean, I had a wonderful supervisor who didn't really know much about film, and that was actually made him, that's why he was a perfect supervisor, because he wasn't sort of carried away and like, oh, look at this film, look at the other film. He was more like, well, why would you want to write on that? So it sort of made me up my game.
Useful questions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of needed that. I didn't need somebody who was just going to say, oh, this, you know, let's have a conversation about our shared love of film. In a way, I had to make that case. But that shows that there's another whole sort of layer there. Which obviously wrong-footed and surprised you, which suggests that it probably says more about the supervisor than about you. But obviously we can only speculate there.
But I think it says something about the things that mainstream culture finds it acceptable to talk about. I mean, we talked about mental health a bit earlier, and it is great that it's more open and more talked about than it used to be. But it's also still very. There's the right kind of mental, and I'm going to have to say mental ill health because I'm a terrible pedant. There's the right kind of mental ill health. It's easy enough to talk about this, but once you go a step beyond that, you can't talk about that. I read some interesting stuff around fat studies, which make a similar point, that we're going for body acceptance, body positivity, brilliant. But the bodies that you see represented, they still have the hourglass shape. It's just on a bigger scale. So there's no... you know, fat people who are fat in the middle, or fat women anyway, who are fat in the middle, they're still invisible. That's still not okay to be proud of that. So there are some restrictions that perhaps we don't even realize necessarily are restrictions in what we are and aren't prepared to make acceptable. It's like gay marriage, fantastic. Poly marriage, no. You know, we still, I'm not saying we shouldn't be taking down these barriers or that we haven't been successful in taking down some barriers, but one of the things that taking down some barriers does is highlights where other barriers go up.
Yeah. Well, and we see it at the moment over trans rights, and that's something which you know, even actually it's our local MP in Canterbury who is the one who's in the news at the moment because of her concerns, and she was saying that, you know, she feels that she can't go to the Labour Party conference because of death threats. Now we're into territory here where, you know, you sort of think, you know, I think it's okay for me to mention that, but of course if I was to then go and start trying to express a view, which I'm not going to do, then that would be utterly counterproductive. But you can see how, what a hotbed this sort of thing is. And I don't know if it, you know, will we look back in 20 years' time and think, oh, well, you know, we kind of all, you know, we were all sort of trying to work out some very problematic and issues, but somehow we've managed to move forward. Or actually, is this just something that's never going to be sort of resolvable?
You see, to me, I think one of the things that hinges on is how willing we are to accept that some things are complicated. Because it seems to me, I'm a shout at the television person, I don't know about you, but you know, you listen to the news, you listen to the talking heads, and I'm a, oh, rubbish, stop doing it, like they can hear me. And one of the things that I say over and over again is it's not that simple. And I get that you have to simplify things to a point if you're going to legislate for them, but then legislation again creates other problems. I read a book about sex work not very long ago that really struck a chord with me, and the point that they made is that as soon as you pass a law on sex work, even if it's a law to say in these forms sex work is legal, you also make a huge category of sex work that isn't legal, and thereby you create a problem for people to be exploited and abused and penalized for things that perhaps they can't help because that's their job and they need to make money. And oversimplification says that, okay, I've passed a law that gay marriage is now legal, therefore we have no issue with homophobia. Yeah. Well, if only that were true, you know? And are you gay enough or not gay enough? Yeah. I remember talking to a couple of people in my research who made, in separate instances, the point that they weren't. So one of them was he had a beard. It was fairly obviously a man, telling me about being refused entry into somewhere, or fairly obviously male presenting, I should say. He did identify as a man. I should mention that. Tell him about being refused entry into somewhere for not being queer enough, even though he was wearing a skirt and heels. Mm. Like, who says what's queer enough then? And then another, I spoke to one intersex individual who was fascinating to talk to in terms of the physical gender cues that we sort of take for granted, because I've never seen anyone shift so strongly between presenting female body language and masculine body language.
and they sort of shifted between them seamlessly. It was obviously very natural for them. But it really struck me because it was such a new thing for me. But again, they were saying, you know, I'm not queer enough for these spaces, but I'm too queer for these spaces. Where then do I go? And a lot of their kink had been around making their own space for that reason. So, you know, I run these events, I make these spaces because I don't fit into either of these places. And I think one of the ways that we navigate these things is we recognize that it's complicated. And not just pay lip service to that, that we accept internally that it's complicated and that we can't reduce it down to, well, there's men and there's women and there's people in between. That's far too simple.
Yeah, you just reminded me, actually, because I went to university 30 years ago, and I remember a conversation in a support group that I went to. It was in my first year at university, when somebody was there saying that they had a problem with anybody who was claiming to be, or self-identifying, that's the word I mean, as bisexual. But they said, no, you know, you're either gay or you're straight. And I mean, looking back now, you think, God, that's such so naive. And actually, you know, that's insulting.
Still pretty common, you know, I think.
But what I think is probably somebody who maybe is gay and maybe had struggled to come out as gay is then like meeting some, this is, and I'm guessing, I'm thinking of a conversation with somebody who, you know, I randomly remember sort of, you know, 30 years ago, and probably just thought, well, either you are or you're not. Don't try and straddle a line. And I can see where they were coming from. But if you are genuinely bisexual, then in that sense, the idea that somebody is telling you that, you know, always like make up your mind which one you are, is profoundly insulting, but also absolutely, completely, you know, it's the Brexit debate all over again. You know, sort of idea that it's this or that, as if there are two choices and that's it. And that's all we're giving you.
And I wonder sometimes if sort of studying kink has made me more aware of this, because one of the binaries that most people take for granted is pleasure pain. Hmm. And I mean, I get asked this sometimes by play puns, like, is this pleasant or painful? And I'm like, well, it's both. Or perhaps sometimes it's neither. So I don't have a name necessarily for what it is. It's these assumed binaries, and they become so fixed and so absolutist, and that becomes destructive. And I don't really see how it can't become destructive, because it invalidates swathes of experience that many, many people have.
Yeah.
I would not want society to be totally sort of closed and inward looking, and my experience is the only thing that matters, because that leads us to Trumpism and crazy conspiracy theories. Of course, my experience is not the only thing that matters. But if you're denying bisexuality, for example, then you're telling me that I don't exist. This is one of the issues for trans people. You're not saying it's not just a linguistic issue, is the point. This is people's lives. This is people's existence. If you say trans isn't a real thing, then you're saying these people are not real people. And we all know the terrible things that can be done to people you've classified as not real people. It matters. It really does. And an insistence on binary choices, there are almost never absolute binary choices. There are always these boundary blurring things that I said at the start of our conversation fascinate me, and they do fascinate me. But I'm also fascinated, although in a less happy-making way, by how desperately some people cling to the binary.
Yeah.
In the face of evidence to the contrary. I mean, I remember having a conversation with a researcher on non-religion. Non-religion is a phrase that really annoys me, because while I accept that plenty of people identify as non-religious, the things that people study as non-religion are exactly the same. And this researcher had been talking about the Sunday Assembly that I'm sure you've come across. And they had explained that these are people who meet up on Sunday and they sing songs together and they do life-affirming stuff and they feel spiritually uplifted. And I said, so how is this different from religion? And he said, well, it's not a religion. So yes, that's actually answering my question. I understand they identify as non-religious, but the practices and experiences you're describing, how are they different? And I went through that list of things like, well, this would also go in religious without any difference to their descriptions. This would also go in religious without any difference to their descriptions. And this is my justification for the entirety of my research, really. If I can take these descriptions and put them in the category of religious without changing a single word, then it makes sense to look at it through the prism of religion and see what that has to tell me. And that's not the same as saying it will always be religious in every possible circumstance, but it is saying that that binary doesn't always make sense and it's not absolute. Could I make this person understand this? Could I buggery? This is non-religion. It's non-religion. It just is. It's non-religion. It's a different thing. How is it?
Absolutely, because I always found with implicit religion, because that's a lens for looking at something rather than the label that you would have. So you wouldn't say, I'm an implicit, well, how would you even say it? I'm an implicit religionist. I'm implicit.
It would sound a little odd.
My religion is implicit. No, it's the framework, it's the lens for looking at that.
Yeah, exactly.
rather than a label that you would claim. Because on that basis, if otherwise you'd say, well, I've never heard of implicit religion, therefore that I can't be that. But you'd say, but you fit the paradigm.
I have actually written a paper about this, if I can plug myself. I gave a paper at the BASR conference a few years back on the different uses we give to the same word and how important it is that research doesn't conflate the two. So we use words like religion, implicit religion, lived religion, all of those terms. We use them in two ways. You can use religion as a category label, as in this is a title for all of these things that go in that box. And it's also an identity label, as in I am religious, you are religious. And those two things are not the same thing. If we're going to use it as a category label, we have to be prepared to look at things that the identity label doesn't call religious, and vice versa. And that seems like such a clear distinction to me. I'm not sure whether it's a realization that I arrived at through my research, or whether I've always thought that and I found arguments to support it. Seems like such a clear distinction to me. And so much of the conversation around all of these things sort of seems to conflate those two, not just academic conversation, but general conversation. This is an identity and it's a thing, and they're the same, but they aren't the same.
And I suddenly realised, well, we've been having this wonderful debate about definitions and terminology, and I didn't even ask the sort of the very sort of obvious questions that perhaps would make sense to have started with, which was just to talk about, you know, where you're from and sort of particular influences or things that you did in when you were young that sort of led to where you are now. But do you want to say a little bit about where you're from, Alison?
Yeah, where I'm from, I'm from a town called Fleet in Hampshire. And I used to tell people that at university on the assumption they wouldn't have heard of it. And they'd go, oh, yeah, Fleet Services Junction, yeah, 6 of the M3. Everyone's bloody heard of it. It's a horrible place. I live in Reading now, so I haven't really ended up going very far. So I suppose where I am now has evolved out of my personal roots to education. So I mentioned that my first degree was in law, and I did my final year dissertation for that on the legal history of witchcraft, which was fascinating, but it also really opened my eyes to how intertwined religion has been with other things. So the religious studies I did at school, as with many people, was fairly awful, and it put religion into this sort of container that's cut off from everything else. So researching for that dissertation sort of made me aware that it's not cut off from everything else and probably never has been. So it was a sort of starting to think about cultural relationships, but it also made me aware that I'd been done a disservice actually with the poor RS that I'd had. So when I decided I wanted to be a teacher, I decided I wanted to teach religious studies, PGCE and secondary religious education. And I taught for 10 years or so up in Nottingham. And I did a lot of work. I ended up writing the schemes of work for my department in my NQT year, so my first year of teaching, because basically I started at the school, I did half a term, and then my head of department, who was the only other specialist, had a nervous breakdown. So it became my department by default for the rest of that year. And he was a lovely man, but his schemes of work were from the, you know, 1950s. And I really didn't want to teach some of them. So with his permission, I played around with them and wrote new ones. And one of the sort of themes that came out of writing those was this fascination that I continue to have with what religion is, why we talk about it the way we do, what difference how we talk about it makes to our understanding of it. And I was exploring those with kids. So the first thing I would do with my year seven, we had a module called Religion, What and Why, as in, what is this thing and why do we bother studying it? And we would look at things like the nature of truth. What do we mean when we say something's true? Different kinds of truth. Did that with year eight. So all sorts of philosophical, epistemological things about religion mixed in with the more traditional world religion stuff. Although I was skeptical about the world religions paradigm even then, to be fair. But you have to do some of it. And then I moved back down. Nottingham's not really north to anyone who lives in Nottingham. It felt north to me. I moved back down south to live with my partner then, he's my husband now. And I decided I wanted to go back and do another qualification. And I decided I wanted to do it in religious studies, sort of a bit of a mismatch. I did my law degree, and then I had another undergraduate degree that was an open subject that I did while I was trying to decide whether I wanted to teach or not. Then I had my PGCE, and they made me do some extra stuff to make sure I had enough knowledge to teach religious studies, but I didn't have a religious studies related qualification. And I'd got quite passionate about the subject by then. I really wanted to have a religious studies related qualification. So I did psychology of religion masters. And as I was doing that, some sort of different strands of interest started to come together. And I opened my thesis by putting together that religion, what and why module with year seven, with a rejection by a partner of any kind of kink whatsoever, because it was just wrong, which was the first time I'd ever encountered that. And those two things don't directly connect together, but over the years of pondering on those two questions, they started to come closer together, started to feel like they were dealing with the same sort of issues, like questions of who I am and what it means to be me and what my experiences, how my experiences impact on other things, how I understand other people's experiences. And then while I was doing my master's and I was looking at the chosen pain issue, and I started to think more about that in relation to kink, which is obviously not just about pain, but pain is what everyone assumes that you're talking about. So some things cropped up in that research that would turn out to be relevant later for my PhD. And basically I said to myself, I'm really quite enjoying this. I think I'd like to do some more research. If I get a distinction in my master's, I'll look at doing a PhD. Didn't really think I would get a distinction in my master's, but I did. So then I started thinking about doing a PhD. Yeah. And I had a serendipitous encounter. So, you know, people say, oh, choose the right supervisor and everything else will be fine. And I did not know how to choose the right supervisor because kink is such an under-researched thing. I couldn't find a kink researcher as such based in the UK. Most of the religious studies research I'd come across seemed like it would not respond well to my idea. And then I was doing working with an exam board. I was at a meeting for a development of a new syllabus, and I met another consultant there who I'd never met before, who had just finished doing their PhD with the Open University. And we were chatting before the meeting, as you do, and I was saying what I was interested in, and he said, oh, you should talk to my supervisor because he would love that. And that's what I did. Yeah. So it was serendipity at that point. And he did love that idea. And I got funding through the OU as well, which was lovely. And here I am.
Yeah. And also in terms of making a mark, I mean, and that's something which I think you've clearly done, because I think you're doing research in an area that it just kind of feels that, you know, I'm conscious of this with my own students sometimes, that, you know, I'm thinking I really have taught this for quite a few years. And although it may be new to them, because obviously if they're 18 and, you know, they didn't know that I was doing this 5 years ago or whatever. But there is a sense sometimes in which I'm aware that I need to press that reset button. And I think what you're doing feels really cutting edge. And also, and whenever your name comes up, you know, in relation to conferences, it's always like, oh, that is such a good area, good research. It's like, you know, it's so important that Alison is doing that. It just kind of feels well, no, but it also just feels like, well, yeah, because if you're not doing it, who is doing it? And would it mean that nobody is doing it?
Certainly not very many people, no. And that's a bad thing in a different way, because it means you don't get the sort of internal discussions and the sort of specialized perspectives as opposed to the non-specialized perspectives. I would like to see more people researching it from all different perspectives. I mean, the fact that I used a religious framework doesn't mean that's the only interesting framework to use. Okay. But I don't think I haven't exhausted that frame. I think there's plenty of other stuff to be looked at through that frame as well. It is something people are interested in, and it's going to sound odd. I've been surprised how interested in it people are. So when you go to conferences with your fellow PhD candidates and you're talking to other PhD candidates, and I'm talking to people who are worried that no one will turn up to their paper and there'll only be three people in their paper. And my worry is that the room will be stuffed and I won't have time to deal with all the questions. So I've never had that empty seminar room experience when I'm giving a paper. And I don't imagine for a minute they just come to hear me. You know, they come to hear the whole panel, but it's never just been one person with a peripheral interest. And people say that when they ask me questions, they go, well, this isn't my area of expertise, but it resonates with me here, and it resonates with me here, and it resonates with me here. So it kind of has a breadth of appeal, I think.
I think also you can turn this hugely to your advantage, in the sense that I'll give you an example. A colleague of mine was couldn't be, you know, I'm terrible with names, and sometimes she was like, she said, "Oh, the name's eluding me," but she's doing BDSM, and I said, "Oh, Alison, yes, Alison," and suddenly this real, like, yeah, it was such a good paper. It was, and also I think this is the thing, because you can say you've got your book, you've got your PhD, you've got your credentials, you're doing this area, people are coming to it, so turn it around. So it's, you know, it's more that you now, maybe when you started, of course, as everyone does when they're doing a PhD, you feel that, I certainly had it, that imposter syndrome. It's like, you know, am I allowed to do this? Am I going to get away with it? But now that you've got inverted commas, got away with it, you can actually turn the narrative around and say, but why shouldn't you be employed to do this? Why, you know, what is the problem? And you turn it around to the person who might have the problem with it, rather than you, who's actually worked through it and actually overcome what must be along the way some potentially quite difficult explanations and scenarios, even to the point of maybe having a supervisor who was a bit wary about writing a reference for you.
That's true. And I mean, it is, the turning it round thing is interesting. I had a conversation a couple of years ago now with someone who is looking to do some research on how kink culture relates to consent. And they worked in education. So they were talking about the advantages of teaching children how the kink community negotiates consent, which are, I mean, they're massive. There would be massive advantages to it. The whole explicit consent thing and open communication about what you are and aren't going to do is built into the whole kink experience, because you're asking for trouble if it's not. And I had a whole section in my thesis about how it's not enough to say, oh, yes, I'm kinky, are you kinky? Brilliant, let's go and do something together. Because kink could range from, I want to see you wearing high-heeled shoes, all the way through to, I want to tie you up and cut strips out of your skin. If I'm into one and you're into the other, we're not going to have a good time. So the utility of the research was obvious to me, but she hasn't managed to get funding for it yet, as far as I know, because the idea of connecting sex research, and I have to give it the inverted commas because it's not, that's another area in which it's really complicated. The idea of connecting sex research to the education of children was just a step too far for some people. But why? Why? And that why question, I mean, it continues to fascinate me, I suppose, that, and the assumption that you have a right to judge what other people choose to do with their bodies is, it seems to me, to be what underlies the sort of negative attitude, judgmental attitude to it, is that there is an assumption that these things are okay to do with your body. If you're going to do anything else, I have a right to judge it. There's something wrong with it. Society judges it. I do think it connects to bodies somehow, and how we view bodies as a society.
Well, and of course, also the fact that you're thinking and working with these very questions means that you're actually even more qualified, because you've thought them through, rather than, you know, in some way taking risks. I mean, I suppose the equivalent would be somebody, I don't think this has ever happened to me, but somebody who says, oh, because you watch all these films that are violent, that therefore you are promoting violence. And of course, that's never happened, but of course, and it's absurd to say that. You know, I watch a Martin Scorsese film, so, you know, and his characters are often gangsters. You know, does that mean that I'm therefore, you know, promoting that lifestyle? Well, hardly, but that's the interesting thing. But the fact is that you're raising and critiquing those very questions. If you're not doing it, who is, in that sense? Because the films are there.
Well I certainly have other stuff I want to say about this, and other questions I want to explore about this, and things I want to do with it. So it's not, and I guess that's perhaps the mark of a good PhD. I haven't had enough of it yet.
Yeah. No. Well, and just a couple of questions as we start to wrap up, Alison. Would you say, as you survey your whole life and career, that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Oh, that's going to be one of those questions. I'd have to say that's more complicated than that. Because I think you cast memories in different lights depending on what you're connecting them to, don't you? Certainly my memories of my research are predominantly positive ones. I can think of a couple of negative research experiences I had. But I mean, I've used them in writing papers. So my first ever academic conference, I was told by an established academic I was not studying religion. Wasn't open for discussion. Categorical. You're not studying religion. And I've opened a number of conference papers with that story because it gives me a useful way into a number of things. So while it was deeply distressing at the time, I was right in that, you know, I was only 3 months into it, maybe right into that. Should I really be doing this? Is this okay? It was really upsetting. But I look back at it now and I go, well, if they hadn't said that, then this would be a very different paper to yeah. what it is now. And that puts a positive spin on the memory. So it's less about what you remember and more about what you do with what you remember, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, and you've actually just made me think that it was about 11 years ago, and I've used this anecdote like every year with my students, when a student, and she was representative of lots of other students, who put up a hand in a seminar I was running, and she said, I'm not religious, but... And I just thought, oh, come on, you know. And I thought, we're doing a module where we're deconstructing the term religion, and you're going to say that. And I know what she meant, but also it's almost like saying, you know, considering the module is about the definition of religion, this seems like a really odd thing to say. But also, I also thought, well, you know, I can capitalize on this for the rest of my career.
Thank you for that.
But also turning the question on its head about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences, because it seems, I mean, maybe nostalgic isn't the right word, and maybe negative isn't the right word, but what you've just demonstrated is that something happened or somebody said something that challenged you, but you sort of came back fighting and you actually said, okay, I'm going to turn this into a positive, because it's that misconception that makes you be clearer. It's done you a favor, because it makes you be even clearer about your own rationale.
Yeah, nostalgic is one of those interesting words, isn't it? I'm just wondering what the dictionary definition of nostalgic actually is, because you assume it has a positive flavour to it, don't you? But one of the words that was important to my research, certainly to writing up my research, was intimate and intimacy. And you assume intimacy is positive as well, but actually that's not a requirement of the definition of the word. And one of the observations that I think is really important and perhaps needs to be addressed more explicitly than it is, that another researcher that I read, and it really struck me, is that what makes rape horrific is that it's intimate. Yeah. It's not something else. It is intimate. It's somebody being intimate with you that you have not chosen to be intimate with. And that is the horror of it. So I'm just wondering if that positivity is intrinsic to the definition of nostalgia, because if it's not, and it becomes a really interesting, why do we then put that positive spin on it always if it isn't? And what would it mean to have negative nostalgia about something? Is that perhaps what PTSD is about?
Absolutely. And actually, well, I mean, the way I would look at it is that there is always something bittersweet about nostalgia, because it's that sense of something that it will actually fits with what BDSM is as well, in the sense of, you know, is it pain? Is it pleasure? Because it's like a longing for something that you either did have or thought you once have, and perhaps you'd like to reclaim or have it back, but you know that it's unlikely to happen. So there's this wistfulness, this melancholia, and it's neither pain nor pleasure, but it's the boundary in between. And also, I also think that nostalgia, I've learned this through doing, you know, 120 of these. I've learned something.
Is that you've probably thought about that word more than me then.
but nostalgia is not about the past. It is, because it's the reflection from the vantage point of where we are now. And similar to what we were saying earlier about the way that academic contours change over time and definitions and perceptions change over time, I also think the way we navigate the past changes. And it's if there's something missing in your life, then sometimes, or something's wrong, or there's a loss or a breakup of a relationship, or somebody has passed away, or you're at a career midpoint or whatever it may be, or endpoint or whatever it might be, that sometimes there's that almost need for, well, once upon a time, something seemed okay. I was on a trajectory that seemed safe and secure, and I'm not on that now. Can I get back on that? What are the steps I take? So there's a lot of looking back, but also it's a way of reframing and reconceptualizing something in the present.
That's made me think quite a lot of things all at once. I really like the idea of nostalgia being something that exists on that boundary, not on either side of it, but right on the boundary. That really resonates for me. But I also find that idea of using it to reframe, I mean, again, that resonates with my research. So there's a strand of kink research looking at kink as beneficial to mental health as a way of dealing with some forms of mental illness. And there's problems with doing that, of course, because it leaves it in the realm of psychology and it leaves it in the binary of good, bad. But one of the things that comes out of that is observations that some people are using kink experiences to recreate trauma. So again, rape would be the obvious example. People who have been raped. And I've read about one example of a woman who was gang raped and recreated that event through kink scenes and did it multiple times to enable her to take control of it and to reframe it and to reshape it in ways that had not removed the trauma exactly, but that stopped her reliving the trauma every time she thought about it, because she'd been able to reshape the trauma into something else.
Yeah.
And that perhaps is, again, working on exactly that nostalgia boundary that it's not this and it's not that. It's its own thing and I can use it to make something else out of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. And I suppose actually, because in my case, you know, somebody who doesn't know me very well might think, oh, Chris is going to watch all these 90s thrillers or erotic thrillers or gaslighting films. And it's like, yeah, but anybody who knows me knows the reason. If somebody will interview me one day, or they, you know, that's going to happen. And I'm sure I'll talk about this, but there is something in my own background that something has happened. So watching these films is a way of playing out and trying to find new ways of dealing with something or new angles on something that makes no sense to me when you realize that you know your own life kind of is like living out a 1940s film noir or a 1990s erotic thriller or something, and it's a case of, you know, going there to try and work something out in yourself. So there is a sense of revisiting trauma, and I can understand why somebody would do that, even though it feels against the grain of what you expect to someone, because you normally say, you know, you're trying to move somebody away because you're supporting somebody from something that is causing them distress. But in moving somebody away from something that's distressful, in a way could be perceived in some context as a way of trying not to engage with it. And then where's that going to be channeled? Where's that going to go? You know, if somebody says to you, oh, you've had a bad time, forget about it. Forget about that person who's caused you that distress. Well, that can actually be even more traumatic.
Yeah, there's something there, I think. Going back to our mental health conversation, one of the things that distresses me about current discourse about mental health is a tendency to medicalize natural human reaction. So while I recognize anxiety disorders exist and you can be anxious about things to a pathological level, worrying that I left the oven on because I don't remember turning it off, that's not a psychological disorder. Being sad because somebody's died is not clinical depression. And yet we're starting to talk about them like they're the same thing. And I think that relates to what you were just saying in terms of sometimes the best thing to do is to sit with what hurts and to accept that it hurts. And we don't, culturally, we don't want to do that. And I get why we don't want to do that. But sometimes that is what you need to do. And I think, and this is my whole thought about religion right here, really. So I use the term religioning in my thesis and my book, because I think it's an active process. I think it's an active process. And I looked at the aspect of it that was meaning, world and story making is what I crunched it down to. And I don't think that's all it is, but I think practices that help you make meaning or make your story or make your world can legitimately be considered as religioning. That's a lens to look at them through. And one of the things you need to do that is to be able to say, this is how I feel right now. And it's okay to feel like this right now. I might need to try and understand better how I feel about this right now. But if you never sit with it, you never even realize you need to understand it better, do you?
Yeah. And there is something in that sense cathartic. But it's funny, isn't it, how we, even I now, you know, because for me, going to the cinema might be therapy, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend, you know, to somebody else that they do what might be perceived as an obsession, because you think, you know, you want somebody to be happy and well, but if their way of being happy and well is to channel that and re-engage and to relive something traumatic, well, if that's demonstrably having a positive effect on them, which the opposite isn't or wasn't having prior to them channeling them through this outlet, then actually you can see it as a positive. But it makes no sense. It's a paradox. You know, it's almost like saying that therapy for some people is to engage with something that is almost sort of a way of returning to the scene of the crime, as it were. And that doesn't make any sense. But sometimes we all probably have that inclination sometimes to say, I don't understand something, but I can't just be detached or I can't walk away from it. I have to. And that's why people, for example, who've been, it may be through rape, it may be through sexual assault or abuse, in some ways then want to do something with it to help other people. It's like saying, you know, rather than pretend it didn't happen or forget about it, I actually want to turn that into something positive. That experience happened. I wished it hadn't happened, but because it happened, I can do something with it.
Because I wonder how much, when you said just then it doesn't make sense, I'm going to sound terribly academic now, but I wonder how much of this comes down to the sort of separation of body and mind. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this when I was starting my research and how I wanted to approach this, because they aren't separate things. They are welded together. And yet we talk about them, and a lot of our culture is built around them being separate things. And out of that comes this idea that we're rational creatures and everything must have a rational reason for it. But we aren't really. One of the things I learned from teaching is that you can have philosophical discussion and you can argue someone else into silence. So my kids always used to say, oh, you can't win an argument with Miss Robertson, you just can't. What they mean is they run out of alternative points to say. What they don't mean is I changed their opinion on this issue, because they didn't form their opinion based on rational argument. They formed their opinion based on feeling. And so I think quite often when we say something doesn't make sense, it feels paradoxical, and we've talked about those things quite a lot. What we mean is there's a difference between what we think about it up here and what we feel about it in here. And there's something about putting experiences, not giving them primacy necessarily, rationality is important too, but giving more weight to experiences. And I think you happen on things that work for you, don't you? In this meaning-making, reconstructing sense that we're talking about, I'm assuming there is no point at which you sat down and went, I feel like I need to watch many films because they will help me understand my life.
Yeah.
You just discovered that it worked for you. And I'm starting to think about this, as you know, I have an interest in fandom, live theatre fandom specifically, because it feels to me very different to fandom of a lot of other things. And my favourite show is just back on tour now, Bat Out of Hell, the musical. Go see it. But that was a discovery. It was an accidental discovery. I didn't go to see it the first time thinking, I'm going to really resonate with this and it's going to make me understand fandom in a whole new way. I was like, well, I like this music. I like a musical. Let's see what it's like. And yet you go to it now and there'll be people go to live theatre in cosplay. They, you know, you see people sitting in the audience watching the show wearing costumes that you can see on the stage. And you think, again, they didn't decide to do that without ever having seen the show. They saw the show and it spoke experientially to something. And now they're building on that. And there's something fascinating about that, about letting experience speak in that way, because it's not a thing that society encourages.
Yeah.
You have to find a way that works for you.
I think you're right.
A way to justify it. You say, well, I'm a fan, and no one asked me, you know, why are you wearing this costume? Well, I'm a really big fan of the show. And people are like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's not really an answer to the question. But we're happy to take it. So it's giving it a framework, I suppose. Like, this is a framework that justifies me doing this thing that otherwise appears not to make sense.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think also there's that sense in which nothing is random, or at least it's not random to the person who's doing it. I suppose you can random and fandom. There's a conference paper there, conference theme.
That's the next Religion and Popular Culture conference.
Yeah, there's nothing random about fandom.
I like right. it.
Yeah. Okay, I've got one more question for you.
Okay.
Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person? And I'm aware as I ask that, of course, I'm falling into the binary trap, but kind of deliberately.
Oh, am I a looking back or a looking forward person? That varies with my mood, I think. If I'm in a down, I do have a tendency to depression. If I'm depressed, I'm very much a looking back person, and I'm not in a reworking kind of way, in a everything's shit, look at all of these terrible things kind of way, and a very self-judgmental way too, as in, you know, you didn't handle that right, you didn't deal with that, you should have done this, you should have done that, you didn't make the most of that opportunity, those sorts of things. If I'm on more of an equilibrium, do I look forward? I'm not a planner, really. Certainly not a long-term planner, as in 5 years I want to be here. But I probably do look forward more than I look back when I'm on that even keel, in the sense of thinking, what can I do next? What's out there? What's happening? And I do like, when I think about things, you know, when I react to things on the news, or I'm thinking about things like fandom, I do like to think about it in forward terms rather than backward terms. So I'm less interested in the history of fandom than I am in what fandom means now and what it will mean as the world changes, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, Alison, it has been amazing to... we've covered a ridiculous amount of topics.
I think we
probably could have gone on for another hour or more, but it's been wonderful. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Oh, it's been really enjoyable. Thank you for asking me.